Jack Jenkins is an award-winning national reporter at Religion News Service. A keen observer of the interplay between American religion and American politics. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have been writing about something that many people are talking about right now, which is Christian nationalism. You are perhaps the first reporter that I really watched take this up. And so kudos to you and all the work you've done in it. I'm going to ask you the million, billion, trillion dollar question. How do you define Christian nationalism?
So I actually use a fairly broad definition, and I'll explain that in a second. My working definition is those who believe that America was founded as a Christian nation, and more importantly, that it either has deviated from that Christian founding and needs to return to it, or that it just needs to remain a Christian nation. And I think that second part is even more important than the historical one, because it's kind of the call to action for Christian nationalists.
Right.
And the reason I use that broad definition is that there's a bunch of Christian nationalisms underneath that broad definition.
Say a little bit more about that. How can you delineate any of the nationalisms that you're observing right now?
Sure. I mean, you know, there are certainly some hardline extremist positions. I should note that in the aftermath of January 6th, we've seen a lot of right-wing extremists actually kind of, you know, really take on Christian nationalism as a cause. And they were actually some of the first to start using it as an identity for themselves, identifying as Christian nationalists. These are people like Nick Fuentes, a white nationalist head of the group in America First. He has called for something that he describes, you know, Catholic Taliban rule. He actually has a Catholic bent on his Christian nationalism. Andrew Torba, the head of the right wing social media website Gab, who's known for you know, sharing anti-Semitic messages and whatnot. You know, he's written a whole book on this topic. And, you know, those kind of are more draconian, these different visions for Christian nationalism about, you know, the idea of really kind of pushing a specific kind of rule on other people. Torba's is actually even Christian statism. He's actually willing to he thinks it could work differently in different states, but it's still this idea that you would pass laws to champion a specific form of Christianity. You also kind of have the iterations expressed by people like Doug Mastriano, the gubernatorial candidate in Pennsylvania. You know, that was a form of Christian nationalism that got really popular in the aftermath of January 6th among those some on the right, that kind of fused anti-vaccine, anti-lockdown, anti-mask sentiment with Christian nationalism. That's actually how Doug Mastriano kind of got a following in that state. He was really involved in that movement last year and the year before. And it was through those networks that he kind of, you know, you lifted up this version of Christian nationalism that simultaneously harkens back to older versions, like the, you know, the older religious right, their understanding of history from the 80s and 90s, and then adds to it this sort of kind of pushback against the government, kind of anti-government sentiment, while simultaneously wanting to put themselves in government to pass different kinds of laws.
Let's stick there for a second, because I think that, you know, Mastriano is a really interesting, important example of how it's on Christian nationalism has arrived at the ballot box this year. And we were talking to Rabbi Choper, who is part of the Interfaith Alliance in Pennsylvania. And he has seen that Mastriano has biblical verses on his campaign posters, and the way that makes him feel as a non-Christian, and the way I'm sure many people, Christians and non-Christians alike, feel when the goal is to take power and impose a certain religious perspective on the rest of the population. And, you know, it's very interesting that they're kind of, you know, maybe I misunderstood you. Are they adopting the Taliban as a role model? Did you say that?
That is Nick Fuentes, to be fair, his ideology can be difficult to parse in general, but the phrase he used was Catholic Taliban rule.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So that's a little creepy and scary. And so I wonder if, you know, if you can see other places where you see Christian nationalism as a really important part of the midterm elections, where else can you see that showing up in your work and your reporting?
Yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting about Mastriano is that he kind of, you know, he has rejected the term Christian nationalism, at least he did the last time he was speaking to some mainstream media a year or so ago. But, you know, he's kind of espousing this sort of idea, like he challenges the idea of a separation of church and state. He refers to it as a myth. And in a different interview, went at length saying he doesn't think it exists. You know, we've seen that in at least alluded to in other places. But he kind of like goes deep on this Christian nationalism culture, as it were. More often, we see kind of allusions to it, kind of the way that Trump did, where, you know, they'll make references to it. They will cater to certain communities, but they're not necessarily owning it the same way Mastriano did. Right. So like Ron DeSantis, when he campaigns in, you know, Pennsylvania, or I believe in Ohio in particular, he talks about putting on the armor of God as an aspect of campaigning, which is, you know, just not necessarily a term that would have been used by Ron DeSantis 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years ago, but seems to be part of the rhetoric now. You have Carrie Lake in Arizona, who, you know, she compared the you know, allegation, criticism of her and others to that, you know, the allegations lobbed against Jesus, right? And some of these more vague allusions to faith, you could even find, you know, comparisons to past Republican candidates. But in this particular midterm election, you know, one, the fact that you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene identifying as a Christian nationalist, you know, beginning earlier this year, you know, that is now part of the political discourse. And two, I think equally as interesting is, you know, I wrote a story a couple months ago asking around 50 congressional Republicans what they thought and whether they had any response to Marjorie Taylor Greene's claim that the Republican Party should be the party of Christian nationalism, and wanted to see if they have any response, if they wanted to condemn that or reject that or embrace that. And only two responded, and neither of them refer to Christian nationalism by name. Both of those Republicans actually just, you know, said that they affirmed their belief in the separation of church and state, pushing back more on remarks from Representative Lauren Boebert, who had rejected the separation of church and state in the last few months as well. But all of that's now part of the conversation. So you see inflections of it in all these different races across the country. And, you know, Mastriano is the one that we point to often because he wears it on his sleeve. But if you listen to the rhetoric in a lot of states, it's coming up repeatedly.
Yeah, that is, you know, it's nowhere do we see this in a kind of fabulous or not fabulous in the good way, but fabulicity, or I don't know what, just like a roadshow. Let me put it that way. In the Reawaken American Roadshow. And you know, this is like high production value, including baptism, but it's really a political movement on wheels. And you've done a little bit of looking at that, I think. What are some impressions? How does that relate to the, you know, the candidates across the country using this rhetoric? And how do you see it playing in?
Well, I think, you know, if you're a Republican or conservative strategist, you see things like the Reawaken America tour as elements of your base, right? This is an aspect of, you could see it as kind of this lineage, you know, of Trumpism developing over the course of Trump's tenure in office. And also it took on its interesting iterations after he left office, right? And so the Reawaken America tour really kind of seems to be an outgrowth of what was the Stop the Steal movement that then became January 6th, that then became, you know, anti-vaccine sentiment, and, you know, led by you know, Mike Flynn in particular. They refer to him as America's general, who, you know, the AP has done a lot of reporting about how, you know, he's kind of pushing at a local level these ideas of Christian nationalism, both as part of the Reawaken America tour and other, you know, kind of advocacy that he has done. You see that as just a part of the Republican base, right? And I think one thing that gets left out here is that, you know, those kinds of people who are showing up to events, there was a Pew survey a few months back that sliced America into around 10 different political groups. And the farthest right was a group that they referred to as faith and flag conservatives, which Pew researchers told reporters was their attempt to kind of assess this kind of hardline version of Christian nationalism. And while they only make up around 10%, 9 to 10% of the U.S. population, which is, you know, roughly the same chunks as these other parts of the U.S. population, they make up around a quarter of the Republican Party. And compared to all other political groups, they have the highest level of political activism, you know, second only and then only sometimes to progressives on the far left. And so you put all that together and you see that this group of voters, this group of activated people, the kinds of people that are showing up at the Reawaken America tour, are likely to make up a disproportionate element of the Republican primary voters, or at least a group that punches above its weight. So it leads to people like Mastriano and others being the Republican candidate for these different races, because these are the folks who are showing up in a really big way.
Yeah. I just... Just a comment on the America's general and the, you know, and America's mayor for whatever is the reason, but these people who claim America to be America's whatever tend to not be America's whatever at all, but are, you know, taking a mantle that they neither deserve nor anybody should really hold. What's been the response among that you've seen among other religious leaders, both among conservative evangelicals who reject this, but also more progressive religious leaders from all different backgrounds, as well as secular backgrounds, not as animated, but certainly somewhat organized, I would say.
Oh, yeah. I mean, pushback to Christian nationalism, this kind of modern era of Christian nationalism that kind of sprung up around Trump, kind of goes back really to his 2016 campaign. I mean, you know, within a couple of years there, by 2018, there was already a Christians Against Christian Nationalism organization and sign-on letter. You know, when I was doing coverage of this starting in 2017 and going into 2018, there was no shortage of faith leaders who were rebuking the kind of Christian nationalism they were seeing in the group of evangelical faith leaders that Trump surrounded himself with. The Poor People's Campaign, you know, led by Reverend William Barber, who in addition to being one of the most prominent progressive faith activists, is just one of the most prominent progressive activists in general in the country. You know, the Poor People's Campaign has had as a pillar of their belief system that they put on their website opposition to religious and now Christian nationalism for years now, right? So there has been this systemic pushback along before, you know, January 6th, before the Stop the Steal movement. Since these things have occurred, and since Christian nationalism became, you know, something that people like Marjorie Taylor Greene would identify themselves with, we've seen this surge of discourse around this topic. And, you know, throughout that time period, we've seen a lot of progressive faith leaders and liberal faith leaders push back on it. I will note, by the way, on January 6th, you know, I was in D.C. I wasn't at the Capitol. I was down the street because one of the only in-person counter-protests that day against what was, you know, the rally that was going to happen that then led to the insurrection was actually a group of clergy that were gathered around a Black Lives Matter sign that had been destroyed by members of the group Proud Boys just a few weeks earlier. And that the fact that they were there, the fact that they were part of that demonstration, you know, it speaks to the fact that these faith leaders have been pushing back on, you know, what they were calling by name at the time as Christian nationalism for a long time. The other part of your question, I think, is really important, though, which is that once Marjorie Taylor Greene started talking about Christian nationalism, there has now been this discourse even among conservatives about what that means. And you've seen a lot of pushback even from, you know, what at this point in American history might be described as moderate evangelicals who've been kind of rejecting it. Russell Moore, who, you know, was also very critical of Donald Trump. This is Russell Moore, the former head of the Southern Baptist Convention's political arm, has now written many pieces criticizing Christian nationalism. And one other piece here that I will close on is that in this interim, a lot of these folks have now started articulating specific visions for what they think Christian nationalism should be, and they don't agree with each other, right? For, you know, we, like I said earlier, you have Nick Fuentes talking about Catholic Taliban rule, but Greg Locke, the Tennessee pastor, who has gotten a lot of attention for, you know, his bombastic and inflammatory rhetoric, just a week or so ago, sort of posting on Facebook, advocating for burning rosaries and for burning what he called Catholic statues. And a few days later, he was on stage at the Reawaken America tour. And a few minutes later, Michael Flynn was on stage, and Michael Flynn is Catholic. So there may be some tensions even among Christian nationalists moving forward once they start talking about what they really want in these different versions of the Christian nation.
Well, I mean, you know, if we go back to the KKK or even further back, the rally of what would have been kind of, if not direct lineage, but certainly earlier iterations of this were as vehemently anti-Catholic as anything, in fact, you know, not wanting any more Catholics to come into this country, and this country is not made for Catholics. And so it's very, you know, I'm not sure that they're willing to see the irony that they are now saying that this is meant to be a Catholic country, given the resistance to that. I want to address something that I think you've hinted at, but is there any frustration for you at the with the January 6th commission that there's been no mention of Christian nationalism? You know, when you were so adept at identifying it and showing the symbols and showing how it was an impulse, it seems like they probably are nervous about it. I don't know. What is your assessment of why that has not been more of a conversation topic?
So I think this is a fascinating question. And I should note up front that at least two members of the January 6th committee, you know, Jamie Raskin and Adam Kinzinger, have both separately, when they are not on that stage at the committee hearings, talked about the role that Christian nationalism played in January 6th. Adam Kinzinger in particular has both condemned Christian nationalism by name and said, and told Russell Moore actually, that he didn't think January 6th would have happened the same way without the influence of Christian nationalism. But when they're up on that stage, there has been very little discussion of this. And so I can only speculate, and I know other people have speculated, but I will point out that one of the interesting elements of those committee hearings is how it is very clear to a lot of different analysts, they are trying to appeal not just to liberals or progressives, sure, but to a bigger swath of the American public. And, you know, lawmakers are often concerned about, you know, looking like they're singling out one faith group or one community. And so I think some of the theories I've heard posited here in Washington is that, you know, why would you spend your time discussing Christian nationalism as a motivator for why people did all these crimes when you can spend your time, you know, saying, hey, look, here are the crimes that were done. Uh-huh. And, you know, we need to just, you know, stick to the script of what, you know, convincing the American public that this happened. And, you know, the committee has, you know, arguing who is responsible for it. So that's my assessment of that as to why that is the case. But again, you know, many people, at least two people on that committee, have been open about the fact that they think Christian nationalism played a significant role.
Yeah. I should mention that Representative Raskin also hosted us on the Hill when we did our briefing. So he's clearly
there.
It's on his radar for sure. And I think they've been very calculating in what effect they wanted to have, and I think you're probably absolutely right. Something that is just really hard to get our minds around, but what role is QAnon playing in the Christian nationalist conversation, but also in just kind of motivating what I would just name craziness, like absolute craziness of you know, ridiculous ideas like that have no basis, that, you know, I thought after Pizzagate, where someone was convinced that Hillary Clinton was in the basement of a pizza parlor with, you know, with a pedophilia ring, and then there's no basement and they show up with a gun. Like, it's so absurd, but then there it is. And I'm just wondering, like, but this is, you know, a belief. I mean, it's a belief system. I don't know. Break it down for me, because I have a really hard, I get a little apoplectic talking about it, but I think it has an outsized influence on the way we're addressing lots of issues right now.
For sure. I think, you know, the QAnon movement, I think there was a time period when people were differentiating it from other elements of what is often described as Trumpism. Now, you know, a lot of people, experts I speak with, you know, it's impossible to disentangle it, right? And that includes Christian nationalism. If QAnon and Christian nationalism were ever separate things, they're not now. You know, they quite frequently overlap. You know, when I was referring to that period in 2021 in particular, where there was that kind of spike in anti COVID measures and anti-vaccine sentiment, those sorts of things. You know, one of the events that I covered at that time was a thing called Bard's Fest out in Missouri. And the speakers there just did not distinguish between conspiracy theories and their Christian nationalism. They often intermingled them. And to the point where it became difficult to discern where one started and the other began. And, you know, there's, I've heard other researchers kind of refer to elements of this as what's called conspirituality, right? This
fusion. Oh my God, that word, stop. That's amazing. Okay, that's, now I'm depressed. Yeah.
And I mean, I think for me, there was this symbolic moment on January 6th where you had Jacob Chansley, the self-appointed QAnon shaman, or Q shaman, whose own religious beliefs are actually very complex. You know, he had Norse symbols tattooed on his body. He often appeals to multiple different faith leaders at once. But when, you know, insurrectionists stormed into the Senate that day, there's footage of the fact that Jacob Chansley then led them in a prayer. And, you know, multiple people, and he was when Jacob was leading that prayer, he was appealing specifically to Jesus Christ. And it had, you know, many overtones of Christian nationalism. And you had people in that room who were raising their hands in prayer. And, you know, I wrote a piece, you know, a few months after January 6th, looking at some of the people who were in that room, two of whom are just more rank and file evangelicals who kind of spoke about how that prayer was important to them later. And how one of them said that was like the something akin to that was a seminal image of the movement for him. And so the fact that the Q shaman was leading these, you know, more rank and file evangelicals in this prayer that kind of alluded to Christian nationalism, you know, I think that says a lot about how these things have kind of come together. And things like the Reawaken America tour are kind of a testament to that too. Yeah. How, like, you know, all the conspiracy theories and you know, pushback against, you know, all these erroneous claims about the 2020 election and appealing to this idea of a Christian nation will all happen in the same sentences sometimes. Yeah.
Nothing like a shaman leading evangelicals in prayer to make your mind spin a little bit. I want to talk about the disturbing anti-Semitism that we are seeing, you know, high profile people like Kanye West and Donald Trump. But also, I do feel like there is, like, inherent in Christian nationalism is a belief that people of other faith traditions have a secondary status in the country. They can be tolerated, but they have a secondary status. And I feel for my Jewish family members, friends, I just feel like this feels like an intimidating time because of the rhetoric that has given permit to people, permission to be terrible. And I don't know. I'm wondering if that's something. I know that Religion News Service is covering it, but I'm just wondering how you're reacting to what you're seeing.
Yeah. You know, I think I wrote this story last year about how, you know, in the aftermath of January 6th and the lead up to it, Christian nationalism particularly became this clarion call for, you know, kind of extremist groups. And I kind of talked to extremist experts who are kind of just, you know, we're watching a lot of these online forums and a lot of these prominent voices and these right wing extremist spaces. And they were really unsettled because not only were they seeing kind of like this spike in Christian nationalism in these extremist spaces, where they would take that in a lot of different directions, right? You know, hardcore versions of patriarchy, obviously lots of forms of racism. And as you mentioned, the KKK is a classic example of Christian nationalism in an extremist form that also was virulently anti-Semitic, right? But at the same time, we saw people like I mentioned, Andrew Torba at Gab. You know, he has, you know, shared repeatedly anti-Semitic messages. And some of these extremism experts I spoke with pointed out that in some of these forums, they started seeing, you know, kind of older versions of kind of, for lack of a better term, you know, hardcore right wing neo-Nazi theology that started reemerging, that was being shared, what's called Christian identity with, you know, capital C, capital I, that sort of theology started getting popular in some of these forums, and those voices were growing louder. I think it's important to note that extremists started identifying as Christian nationalist. And then it was like a year to a few months later that people like Marjorie Taylor Greene started identifying as Christian nationalist. So they're clearly, you know, making this their influence heard across these chasms at some point. And so very early on, folks were expressing a deep concern for not just, you know, references to anti-Semitic arguments and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, which are kind of embedded in a lot of QAnon rhetoric, but really virulently old school, hateful versions of anti-Semitism reemerging in some of these circles that, you know, potentially as you widen the net of people who might find this permissible, start being picked up in more mainstream political spaces. So that was the concern that extremism experts were telling me over a year ago.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's not lost on you or me or most people that we just are coming up, or we just passed the 4-year anniversary of the tragedy at Tree of Life in Pittsburgh. And, you know, there's just, I want you to give me a little hope here. You know, I'm a pastor and I should probably be trying to preach some hope, but what stories are you seeing that you're like, oh, okay. You know what? I can't wait to interview them to learn, you know, I mean, what can you give us that is out there in the religious reporting world that you live in that makes you say, okay, we're going to be all right?
I mean, I think this election season is going to be interesting, right? Because I don't know if this is a perfect answer to your question, but for instance, one of the questions I have is, you know, the latest polls on Mastriano don't have him doing particularly well in Pennsylvania, right? And some of these other candidates who were really intensely Christian nationalists actually lost in the primaries. And so there's a question as to whether or not, you know, this election could go one direction where a lot of these Christian nationalists lose. And the hardliners aren't going to abandon Christian nationalism, but maybe that would cut its influence in broader political circles where they're like, well, this doesn't help us win. So why would we double down on this? You know, members of the Republican Party in particular. You know, you also, there's a dynamic where we don't really know what happens when they lose, right? Like Doug Mastriano was at the Capitol on January 6th. He says he left when it got violent. But, you know, he was somebody who was forwarding these conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. So if he loses, there's questions about what that will mean in Pennsylvania. But, you know, there is this interesting element of where there could be a scenario where a lot of the candidates who have appealed to this, particularly ones who have kind of dug in on Christian nationalism, may, you know, have a bad night on election night. In addition to that, I mean, I do think it was true during a lot of elements of the Trump era. There is a big call and response among the American public on these sorts of questions, right? Of democracy in general and also Christian nationalism in particular. For instance, Pew just dropped a poll yesterday that the headline was that 45% of the country thinks that the United States should be a Christian nation. But when you dig into the data, the actual percentage of Americans who believe that you should have, you know, more explicit laws that are explicitly Christian and impose those on others is actually a very small minority compared to that number. And so, you know, when you actually look at the data here, the people who are really out front championing these kind of, you know, hardline Christian national views don't seem to represent a massive group of people. And so if there are Americans who are disagreeing with Christian nationalism, you know, I think it is still very much the case the majority on paper rejects these sentiments. The question is how people will respond on election day and in political activity in general moving forward if they see this as a concern, if they will take movements, if they'll be part of movements to reject it.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, I'll note that as you well know, there is no shortage of activists who have, you know, been pushing people to recognize this as a concern. You know, Christian nationalism, like several other right-wing elements, does seem to express some anti-democratic sentiment. And so, you know, raising the alarm about those sorts of concerns seems to have been a recurring theme in a lot of circles
yeah.
over the last 6 months in particular, and really the last few years.
Yeah, well, that's certainly you know, what we're focusing on at Interfaith Alliance right now, and feel very activated by it. Can you tell us, like, as we close out here, one story of that just knocked your socks off recently about someone in the faith realm doing something that you just thought, wow, that is new. Like, I haven't reported on that before. This person is breaking some interesting new ground on how religion works in society. Is there anybody that comes to mind, or a group, or just a cool story? I mean, I want to get a sneak tidbit of something that you might be you're thinking about reporting on, or someone you came across in your work.
Well, I'm loath to choose one. I will tell you, I do think it's interesting around election time. These stories of how there is no shortage of faith leaders and people of faith who are actively involved in the democratic process, not in a way that's trying to leverage their faith in other people, but just trying to, like, make sure that, like, the polling locations are safe, that people are able to get to the polls irrespective of who they vote for. This is one of those things that a lot, you know, for instance, you know, Souls to the Polls efforts that happen in a lot of Black Protestant churches. You know, there is no shortage of things like that across the country happening right now as all these different states allow for early vote. And it's an interesting thing to note, to recall every, you know, 2 to 4 years as a reporter, because, you know, these are how a lot of people get inspired to vote, how they feel safe to be able to vote, who drives elderly or folks who are disabled to polling locations, how people were cared for once they get there. It's just a constant story about how democracy works, that different faith institutions and groups, again, not pushing their specific theology or even politics on people, are trying to encourage people to participate in the process. And I'm just kind of always struck by that element. I will also say, as something I have found particularly interesting, in a very different topic, you know, after the overturning of Roe v. Wade earlier this summer, you know, the number of faith voices that have always been there and have been a part of the abortion rights conversation for decades, suddenly rising to prominence and claiming theologies that they have been saying more quietly for decades now. And, you know, even filing lawsuits in recent weeks and months to say, you know, actually, you know, abortion restrictions and abortion bans infringe on my particular faith perspective. And here's, like, you know, centuries or millennia of theology to prove this is where I stand. You know, those stories are always really interesting to me, and I think others in the public, because they break our preconceived notions about what it means to be religious in America. And I think there's just stories like that throughout this year that have been really interesting to be reminded of.
Yeah. Thank you so much for those hopeful stories. You'll be delighted to know that the other person who's part of our radio show this week is Dr. Barbara Williams Skinner, who's working on Faith United for to Save Democracy. And she was talking about poll chaplains and really, you know, just getting people out there to help people feel safe. And so that's, you know, that's part of this program. And I love that you mentioned that. It is really important that there is a role for religion to play in democracy, in fact, in promoting democracy. That I think we had Fred Davey, Reverend Fred Davey, come on the other week, he said, like, the we are made in the image of divine. To be able to choose is actually a sacred act. To be able to make a choice is a sacred act, and therefore the vote is sacred. Echoing some words of Representative John Lewis. So we feel very fortunate. And I'll say also on the abortion, like, you know, when I was growing up, my mother was the reason that we went to church. We went to a Presbyterian church in Madison, and my mother founded Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin, and she came at it from a very strong religious point of view. She was, you know, my father was named Walter Rauschenbusch, you know, so that, you know, there's resonance there. But the reason we went to church was my mom, who was like, you know, you're gonna get some learning. And I just remember her, like, those things were joined for her. And so, the idea that there's one way that religious people view abortion or same-sex marriage. In fact, the polling shows that the majority of religious people from the across religious traditions support the right for women to choose around their reproductive health. And support same-sex marriage now. And yet we have
right.
we continue to say, oh, well, the religious voice, you know, we don't want to squelch the religious voice. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, at Interfaith Alliance, we're saying, well, the religious voice, there's lots of religious voices here. So no right. one's one religious freedom should trump another religious freedom. And so how do we balance that? And so I just, first of all, I really appreciate you, your reporting. It's like it is a first stop for anyone interested in religion stories in America. It's really spectacular to talk to you all the time. Jack Jenkins is an award-winning national reporter at Religion News Service and author of a compelling book titled American Prophets, The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country. Jack, thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
I'm afraid that's all the time we've got for this week's show. We've covered a lot of ground, and it's challenging to talk about the threats to our democracy and religious freedom while keeping hope and resilience. Fortunately, I think we found just the right voices to help us do that in this critical moment. These are the stories we need to keep hearing, and that's a key reason why State of Belief is here. We've covered a lot of ground today, and it can be challenging to talk about the current threats to our democracy and religious freedom while maintaining hope and resilience. But talking to people like this, doing important work on the ground, really helps. And these are the stories we need to keep on hearing, and that's a key reason why State of Belief is on the air. I hope you'll consider helping us to amplify the voices doing this critical work by making a financial contribution to keep this program going strong. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. You can be part of making sure informative and encouraging voices like these are heard by sharing this program with friends and family. Let's get more people listening and more people taking part in these conversations, both on and off the air. Never miss an episode by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And join the conversation. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at State of Belief. That's at State of Belief. And share State of Belief with the people in your life. State of Belief is produced by Ray Kirstein and is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. I can't wait. Until then, I'm Paul Rauschenbusch, and that's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.